to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkheim. Later on in the show tonight, we're going to talk to two award-winning journalists who spent 5 years exposing a widespread practice of clean record agreements in California. These are loopholes that let police officers erase misconduct from their records and land new jobs in law enforcement. And then we'll talk to Matt Dooley, the director of a new documentary for diehard and heartbroken Oakland A's fans about their former team. But first, we're so pleased to be joined by Supervisor Cheyenne Chin, who represents District 11 in San Francisco. That includes some of the southern neighborhoods such as Crocker, Amazon, Excelsior, and the Outer Mission. She was sworn into the Board of Supervisors just 2 months ago and brings her background as a union organizer, an immigrant, parent, and caregiver to the role. She's focused on improving city services, and tonight we'll discuss her priorities, including for elder care, youth services, small businesses, and more. Supervisor Chin, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start just by giving you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners. Can you share a bit about your background and what inspired you to run for supervisor?
Thank you so much. My name again is Cheyenne Chen. I am an immigrant. I came from China at age 15. When I first came to San Francisco, I went to Galileo High School, and I spent a lot of time actually in Chinatown and benefited a lot from our city programs as an immigrant youth at the time. So that really inspired me to really giving back to our community to continue to make sure that San Francisco is a community that is uplifting everyone. And I also, it is really grateful that I am also inspired by my children, my two young daughters, and also the community neighbors that who are really trying to make sure that our neighborhood visions of District 11 is uplifted. And District 11, again, it is the most diverse district in San Francisco, and a lot of working family with multi-generation families as well. So, you know, my goal to run, my goal to be a supervisor is definitely to make sure that we continue to amplify our voices, our community voices in City Hall. And it's really important to continue to have representation for District 11 that represent the working family.
Well, Supervisor Chen, it's great to hear a bit about your background. It's quite a story. And also, I appreciate you just talking a little bit about the demographics of your district and District 11. And when you were campaigning, what were some of the common themes that you were hearing from District 11 residents about what they wanted to see?
Yeah, I think there are multiple priority. As a mom and talk to many working families, is like before and after school, better access to outdoor and indoor space services in the district that is serving our youth, children, and senior. It's really important. To name some, is like the library in OMI, and it's also a topic that we talked about last year during our debate.
And do you have specific agenda items or policies that you want to see done, things you're prioritizing, maybe a top three list?
Definitely. For me, it's continue to make sure that I advocate for supportive services for seniors is number one, to make sure that our seniors, our children continue to have indoor and outdoor spaces. And also with the Walgreens closure in the last 2 years, I would say a lot of our neighborhood is also needing like medication services, pharmacists, and more importantly, it's also affordable housing in our community, especially senior affordable housing is something that came to my attention a lot. And again, I think it's really continue to make sure that we have programs for youth, and also supporting our small business corridor is really important. So my goal is also to make sure that we bring more foot traffic to our district neighborhood merchants corridor. And lastly, I'll say this is a year where we are facing a huge budget deficit, but like making sure that District 11 is not having cut is really important, because this is District 11 is already underfunded from all these years. So we are the forgotten district. So I want to make sure that our budget is secure and saving all the important services that is currently existing in District 11.
And your district, District 11, was formerly represented by Asha Safai, the former supervisor who was termed out. And I'm wondering if you see yourself as different in key ways from former supervisor Safai. Can you talk about what might distinguish you from his service on the board?
Yeah, so I think the campaign really set a very strong foundation for me. It's my victory is really a victory of a community coming together. So I actually have the blessing of like having former supervisor Asha Safai's support and also former supervisor Avalos support. And I think also most importantly, it's like District 11's community groups, whether you're in Excelsior, Quaker, or Mission Terrace, or Cayuga, or OMI, together now that I, in my experiences in the last 3 months working with our community, I already see that I'm having a lot more unity in the district, that we are working together to bring community member together, and they're also willing and it's ready to lead to make sure District 11 it's heard and seen. So I would say that the advantage that I have as a District 11 supervisor now, it's really to continue to make sure that I build bridges between community and government to make sure that District 11's constituents and our needs are heard.
We're speaking with San Francisco Supervisor Cheyenne Chen, who represents District 11, including some of the southern neighborhoods in San Francisco. And Supervisor Chen, I know you have an extensive background as a union organizer and a community advocate. Can you talk about how that background, how you think that background might may inform how you will serve now as supervisor?
Yeah, this is really similar to what I just shared. It's like I have a lot of firsthand organizing experiences, and I truly believe that we leading together with our community, it's really essential. So to me, it's continue to make sure that I build communities, I bring people together, and I want to make sure that they are also be a voice that is really hearing and speaking up in City Hall. So I believe in like make sure that we continue to build community and have an inside champion and also outside organizing effort to make sure that District 11's needs are being heard and seen and have real solution and investment to it.
And how do you plan to involve District 11 residents in the decision-making process to ensure that their voices are heard?
Yeah, so like I shared earlier, it's District 11. We do have neighborhood groups, whether you are in Excelsior, you're in OMI, you're in Mission Terrace, you're in Cayuga, you're in Quaker. We do have community groups that currently are very active. And we also have a very active parent groups. So my commitment is to make sure that I keep a very close communication and also make sure that their needs are amplified in the budget, especially the budget when the budget comes this year. It's to make sure that they're informed and also making sure that the department actually knows the current program that is serving District 11, and also making sure that you know the community wants to make sure that, like I mentioned, some of the priority earlier, it's we do want to have more indoor and outdoor space and program like Crocker Amazon's part renovations, Balboa Park renovation, and OMI library, and making sure that we continue to work with department to also provide more senior services like nutrition program and also after school and before school program that is in the district that are supportive to our community and especially our working families.
Yeah. And if you have a question for Supervisor Cheyenne Chen, you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We do have just a few minutes left, but we also might be able to squeeze in your phone call. So if you have a phone call question for the supervisor, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Supervisor Chen, I want to talk to you about public safety. I know that's top of mind for many residents. So what is your strategy or plans to enhance public safety in the district?
So public safety is definitely top of all our priority too among many residents in District 11. And I just have to say that I am very lucky that I have two very experienced police captain in District 11, Captain Herrick and Captain Wu in Taravo Station. They're amazing. And for me, it's really continue to make sure that I work very closely with them. I just want to, you know, also highlight something that we've done. It's like the police station have hosted like regular educational program. It's especially in District 11 for all the seniors. I don't know how many audience know about blasting scams. Blasting scam, it's been impacting the Asian seniors, especially the Chinese seniors in San Francisco. So our captains, our police station have been having education program, and they are all very well attended. So I especially want to appreciate and also and thank their effort of continue to make sure that our residents is taken care and also properly educated with resources. And at the same time, I also want to thank that in District 11, we also have district liaison with the San Francisco Police SFPD. And Sam, his name is Sam Berenson. And Sam has been very helpful, that who is really going around in the district every day to make sure that anything that is related to public safety issues, and he's on top of it, like making sure that our streets clean and helping our neighbors with like non-emergency issues. So, and also working very closely to support our business corridor. Breaking is still happening, but Sam is definitely there to educate them about what we can do and what services we're providing, and also connecting them to proper language services. And so I'm in general very grateful, making sure that we continue to work closely and build a trust, and also advocate for language access is something that I feel strongly about in District 11, because again, we are very diverse in District 11.
Well, let's talk about another big issue, which is housing affordability, especially for seniors and large families. And San Francisco is under a mandate by the state to build nearly 47,000 affordable housing units by 2031. And of course, the city is way behind in meeting those goals. So what specific measures do you plan to advocate for to ensure that District 11 can contribute to the citywide required goal?
Yeah, so my office is working proactively with MOCD and planning to identify sites for 100% affordable senior housing in District 11. And I'm also sponsoring legislation to strengthen the housing preservation effort to enable low-income elders to continue to stay in their apartment through acquisition programs. And I'm also trying to introduce a legislation to strengthen tenant protection in light of mandating to absorb major corridor in the city. I want to make sure that to stabilize, especially our senior and family who may be at a risk or increased risk of like displacement. Unfortunately, there are really not enough money to build all the housing that we want and we need. But I would definitely looking into more opportunity and be supportive of a revenue measure for affordable housing on the next ballot.
All right, and we have an email in from Wendy who asks, where does the supervisor think that this group of supervisors will make their mark? What issues will they be able to make the most progress on? So what do you think will sort of be remembered from this group of supervisors?
To me, I think it is really important that San Francisco, it is still like after COVID, the economy is not recovered. So I think this is for this group of supervisor is definitely making sure that we continue to strengthen our public safety. At the same time, it's making sure that our economy is working for everyone in San Francisco. I think this is something that I feel like myself and my colleagues are committed to, making sure that San Francisco continues to be a city where we welcome family, we welcome everyone to stay, and we have everyone able to see opportunity for thriving.
Well, and speaking of families, District 11 has one of the highest populations of children under 14 in the city. So let's talk about youth services. What do you envision in terms of expanding affordable before and after school programs to support working families?
Yeah, so this is definitely something that I will continue to have meeting with the relevant department. But I know that SFUSD has a lot of facility and space, but we definitely need more coordination for funding to pay for staffing and how to activate those spaces for like after school program and before school program. So I continue to work with the superintendent's office and also all the city department like DEC, DCYF to make sure that continue to align the resources to make whatever that is necessary for funding to make it happen.
And last question for you, for residents who want to stay informed or get involved, what's the best way for them to connect with you and your office?
Yeah, there's definitely, we have a website. If you go to our city government's website, you can subscribe to our newsletter. And my office phone number, if you have any questions related to District 11 or anything that you think my office can be a champion for, please call my office, 415-554-6975.
Great. And we'll make sure we put that up on our website as well. The Supervisor Cheyenne Chen from District 11 here in San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on State of the Bay. We look forward to following your work and hope we can have you back on the show soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Have a great evening.
All right. Okay. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to two award-winning journalists who spent 5 years exposing a widespread practice of clean record agreements in California, which are loopholes that let police officers erase misconduct from their records and land new jobs in law enforcement. That's right after this break, so stay with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. A wrestler honors his family while making a name for himself.
The legacy that I would love to leave behind is somebody who truly cared. People who used to call these guys marks and idiots that just swing stuff. We're idiots that do art and we make this beautiful.
A Samoan dynasty in deathmatch wrestling. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Tonight, we're going to dive into an investigative report that exposes how secretive agreements are allowing police officers throughout California with serious misconduct records to move from one department to another, all with a clean slate. This is an in-depth look at the systemic loopholes that protect bad cops while keeping the public in the dark. So we're excited to be joined by the two journalists who spent 5 years uncovering these hidden agreements. Their reporting has not only revealed how this practice operates, but it sparked legislative action here in California and earned them prestigious awards for investigative journalism. And we'll also explore then what the California legislature is doing in response to their reporting, whether these agreements will finally be banned, and what resistance might stand in the way of reform. And I also want to invite you, our listeners, to be part of this next conversation. Are you a member of law enforcement and have an opinion to share? Are you a concerned citizen who has questions about how these agreements came into existence? You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us with any questions or comments that you have about this issue at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So let's introduce the two journalists who uncovered the story. First, I want to welcome Katie Roush. Katie is a reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program right here in the Bay Area at UC Berkeley, where she's been since 2019. Welcome to State of the Bay, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
And we're very pleased to be joined as well by Casey Smith. Casey is the senior statehouse reporter for the Indiana Capital Chronicle in Indianapolis and a former reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. And that's where she teamed up with Katie to investigate and publish the story that we're talking about tonight. Casey, welcome to you to State of the Bay.
Yeah, thank you. Also very happy to be here.
It's great to have two UC Berkeley representatives here on the show talking about this really important issue. And Katie, let me start with you. Let's just go to the beginning here. How did this investigation start? What led you to start looking into police settlements?
So this started a long time ago, before the pandemic, back in 2019. Myself and another reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program were looking into police officers who had criminal convictions. And we had narrowed our investigation to a particular department who had hired a large number of officers with criminal convictions from a previous department. And these officers also, as we did our reporting, we discovered that these officers also had misconduct in their backgrounds. But as we were reporting and started interviewing some of these officers, what these officers were telling us was contradicting what we were seeing in the records. The officers were adamant that they had not committed misconduct, that they had not been terminated from a previous department, even though their former police chief and records we obtained showed the opposite. And so it left us with this mystery. And this is where Casey comes in. We were having a brainstorming session late one night at work about what was happening here. And Casey suggested by some of the clues that we had given her that potentially there could be settlement agreements involved here. And so we discovered this with a simple request for public records to one agency. And pretty quickly in our inbox were five agreements from one particular department. And once we read the language of those agreements, that's when we really understood that we needed to understand if this was happening at other departments, if this was more widespread, or if this was something that was isolated to this particular police department.
And Katie, when you say police misconduct, what kinds of misconduct were you seeing in their records, and what was the nature of the adjudication process to determine that there had been police misconduct?
We looked at, there was serious misconduct. So it ranged from a variety of things, from excessive force to sexual assault to sexual harassment to dishonesty. And that was one of the things we looked at right away, because we thought, is this misconduct that is being covered up by these agreements, something that is a little more mundane, less serious? And we quickly realized that was not the case. And so we began requesting these agreements from agencies across the state to really understand the scope and scale of this system.
And Casey, let me turn to you. Can you talk about exactly what these clean record agreements are and how they work?
Yeah, it's interesting. We didn't really know what they were at first, but what we came to learn about them, they have lots of different names. But clean record agreements, they're essentially they're legal settlements that are made between peace officers, police officers, and their agencies, the municipalities, the local governments, that in essence allow them to bury or erase their disciplinary records. Typically, that means that officers are able to resign or retire in good standing from the department that they were at, where they had some sort of issue. And in exchange, if there's an ongoing investigation of some sort into that misconduct, that's stopped, it's dropped, and having the settlement agreement in place, like I said, it wipes that record, and it allows them to then go on to other departments, because more often than not, the other agencies where they would apply, they wouldn't be able to see those records of misconduct or those pending investigations. The other thing that these agreements do, though, in addition to burying or erasing the misconduct records, there was oftentimes a monetary piece to that as well, a payout of sorts, and that came in all sorts of different forms. But that was another kind of get that they would have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Casey, how do these agreements come about? Were you able to uncover just sort of the history of the origin of this procedure? This seems incredibly non-transparent, as well as obviously bad policy potentially, to have officers who are, having been adjudicated of committing misconduct, having them just simply transferred around. I mean, it sounds a lot like what the Catholic Church was doing with priests who were accused of child sexual abuse and other types of abuse and just shifted around to different dioceses. Is this seems like the same kind of arrangement almost?
Yeah, these have been around for decades, and they exist outside of California. And like you said, they're not dissimilar from other types of agreements or forms of confidential agreements that exist in across multiple fields. But yeah, I mean, they've been around for a long time. It's a very, very formalized system that exists for these agreements that exist for law enforcement. I mean, you've got unions who are involved, you have municipalities who are involved, you have what we describe in the story, the legal defense fund, that exists to, you know, there are teams and groups of lawyers who for many years have been the go-to for officers when municipalities have an issue and they don't want to be out, you know, exorbitant amounts of money. They don't want to be out millions of dollars. They'd rather be out, you know, thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars more often than not. This has been the easier route.
And Katie, exactly how widespread is this issue? I mean, Casey just mentioned that these agreements have been around for a long time. How many of them were you able to uncover? How widespread was it? And do you think there are more that are still out there to be discovered?
There are absolutely more. When Casey and I did this investigation, we focused primarily on California, but we did look outside of California and found these agreements existing in almost every single state in the United States. But here in California, we found a little over 300 agreements with 163 agencies across the state. But we do know that's far more widespread, because one of the big issues that we had in reporting this story was obviously these agreements were confidential. And so many agencies refused to release most or all of these types of agreements to us, including the largest departments in the state, Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, Los Angeles Police Department, and others.
You're listening to State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're speaking with Katie Roush, a reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley, and Casey Smith, senior statehouse reporter for the Indiana Capital Chronicle in Indianapolis, and a former reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. We're talking about their 5-year expose about the widespread practice of clean record agreements, these loopholes that let police officers erase misconduct from their records and land new jobs in law enforcement. And we want to hear from you. What do you think of this practice? What do you think our state should do about it? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us any questions or comments you have about this practice to stateofthebay@kalw.org. We do have an email in from Shannon in San Francisco who writes, "How is it fair that bad cops get a clean slate while the people they hurt are left with the consequences?" Katie, I want to direct that one to you. And also, as a follow-up, if you could just provide some examples of some of the specific cases that you came across, in addition to answering Shannon's question about the fairness of it all.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to making these agreements, municipalities gave some really interesting reasoning about why they would do this. I think that was a big question initially. It was like, why? Why would they offer this clean slate to an officer who they had determined had committed such serious misconduct that they should no longer work for that department anymore? And what we found was that it was all a monetary decision. These agencies and municipalities were faced with either spending hundreds of thousands, potentially $1 million, to fight an officer who was appealing their termination or disciplinary action. And that was too high a cost to pay for their municipality. And sometimes insurance companies were involved. Usually there is municipal pool insurances where multiple cities get together and they have an insurance with each other. And so they had this obligation to other municipalities to settle and not spend down the money in their insurance funds to fight these claims. And so that's really what it came down to. And then in terms of what sort of misconduct some of these officers were accused of, I mean, I think I mentioned it really was interesting to us to see that the type of misconduct varied. But in one particular case, there was an officer who we followed who his department had determined that he had lied. There was a pending allegation of domestic violence. He had a clean record agreement from an LA area department and then ended up at a different department where he was accused of embezzlement. They had determined that he had embezzled thousands of dollars from his agency. He got another agreement and then another job working as a police officer at three other departments after that second agreement. There was another officer who was accused of misusing his baton. He had an agreement that he used to get a job at a different department where he was accused of tasing a man who was handcuffed to a hospital bed. The investigator had found that out of policy, and he got another agreement and ended up becoming a police chief in Nevada. So there were many examples that we saw over and over again where officers were using these agreements and covering up very serious misconduct that their departments had determined there was enough clear evidence that they had committed that wrongdoing.
Well, truly shocking examples that you're bringing up. I'm sure there are probably many more as well. Casey, you had mentioned briefly just that police union involvement with the origin of these clean record agreements. How much of a role do police unions play in making it difficult to terminate officers? What role did they play just within this dynamic that you and Katie were able to uncover?
Not surprisingly, a very strong, significant role. The police unions in California are they're very strong. In terms of the contracts, it's often the police unions that are negotiating the contracts that include these strong protections for officers, and again, that kind of allows them more of an ability to get these kinds of agreements when there's misconduct. They often are in Sacramento, obviously, but frequently lobbying against stronger accountability measures, and have argued that these agreements are necessary for protecting officers who have been accused or wrapped up in wrongful termination or they're wrapped up in misconduct investigations that are unfair, or, you know, obviously their take on this is the intention is to keep officers from having to face repercussions that they don't think that they deserve. Obviously there's
Yeah, they're a big part of the story here. Let me ask you, Casey, just as a follow-up, because you mentioned that they're active in Sacramento, but are there, given that this practice is happening across the country, are there states that have successfully been able to ban or even regulate these agreements where, you know, potentially perhaps the police unions, their political presence is not as powerful?
Yeah, there have been some states. I don't know if there's a specific example of a state where they've completely outlawed these necessarily, but Colorado might be a good one where they have taken some directed action at these. In 2016, there was a law that their lawmakers passed that requires law enforcement officers in that state to sign waivers that allow hiring agencies to look back at their entire background. And that would mean that any sort of confidential agreements that have been signed into since 2016, that would be visible to the hiring agency. It doesn't, if I recall correctly, it does not affect any sort of confidential agreements that were made before 2016 when that law got passed, however. But that's a specific example of a state that really took kind of some targeted action. There have been a few others. Alaska's one. There have been some in Michigan, maybe Connecticut as well, that have also taken some action. But again, it's not... I don't know that there's been a law 100% directed and prohibitive of these types of agreements.
And Katie, can you tell us what the California legislature is doing now in response to this investigation that you both were able to put out there?
Katie, Kansas.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Proceed. Yeah, it was just a little choppy in the beginning, but we got you now.
Sorry about that. If I can just clarify on the Colorado law, it specifically nullifies the confidentiality provisions in any agreement post 2017. And there's a Kansas law that nullifies confidentiality provisions of any of these agreements since 2018. So those were probably the most targeted laws. The one in California that's been proposed is more expansive. So Assemblymember Isaac Bryan has proposed a law that would prohibit agencies from using these confidentiality clauses in agreements with officers. And I've been told that the goal is to not only ban the future use of these confidentiality terms, but to actually nullify them going back in time. So all of these agreements that we've seen that are being used and being effective and bearing this misconduct, this bill would address those as well.
We're speaking with Katie Roush, reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley, and Casey Smith, senior statehouse reporter for the Indiana Capital Chronicle in Indianapolis. And Casey is also a former reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. And we're talking about the practice of clean records agreements that allow police officers who are accused of misconduct to move to other districts without anyone knowing about their past behavior. And if you just joined us, this is State of the Bay. We're on local public radio here, 91.7 KALW in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we want to hear from you. What do you think about these type of agreements? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with your questions or comments on this practice at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we do have an email in from Kenneth in Nevada who writes, could clean record agreements for problematic officers ever serve a greater good, such as encouraging resignations without costly legal battles or allowing second chances for those who made mistakes but show genuine reform? I appreciate Kenneth trying to look at where the upside might be of these practices. Katie, I'll give you the first crack at responding to that question.
I think that's definitely the question and definitely the feeling of some in law enforcement is that these agreements provide a really useful tool to agencies to allow an officer to resign without a protracted appeal of a termination. And I think the other side of that is there are some times when officers just have a personality conflict with their department and potentially want to sign an agreement to make sure that they can exit and remain in their profession. We did not find in our examination of these agreements any where the allegations of misconduct were not really serious. Kind of the lowest level of seriousness was issues of dishonesty and credibility, which if you know anything about law enforcement, honesty and credibility is really one of the cornerstones. One of their primary jobs is to testify and write reports, that allow people to be arrested and charged with violations of the penal code. And so I think that if we had seen those agreements being used in that capacity, I don't think we would have honestly continued with the investigation. But of the 300 or so that we found and what we could uncover about the misconduct, they were all very serious issues of misconduct and not related to something where there was a personality conflict. But I do appreciate the listeners' thoughts on this being a way for an agency to get rid of another officer. And I think there are some in law enforcement who really do feel like that is a tool they want to continue to use.
Yeah, well, we have an email in from Jeff who writes, "This story is so depressing about our government at a time when our government is feeling under attack and fragile. Government is supposed to be working for us. I'm wondering how the guests feel about the government after reporting on this." Casey, what's your response to that email from Jeff?
I just want to make one note on the last question, too, which is that these clean record agreements are one flavor of settlement agreements. Officers can still enter into settlement agreements with their agencies that are not these secretive clean record agreements that wipe, misconduct or bury it, what have you. And we actually consistently over the course of requesting so many records from all these different agencies, those are some that we would get too. But those weren't the ones that we were looking at, right? And again, those other type of settlements, you know, where there's been a disagreement, discrepancy, I mean, what have you, between an officer and their agency, those exist. Those are common. These are kind of a subcategory of that, and they do something that the intention is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. In terms of government, this type of practice broadly is not something that's exclusive to just law enforcement. Again, they're, you know, across all different agencies of government, branches of government across all different states. I mean, there are actions taken to hide, I don't want to just say hide, but to you know, do different things with records, to you know, do things with records about employment, money, you know, what have you. I think the biggest thing is doing the kind of work that we did, which is just to shine a light on that. And the onus is really on the folks who have the decision-making power to change these kinds of practices. I think, again, that's just the importance of this kind of work is just to, you know, put that in the spotlight for folks to know about so that they can kind of have it on the table and decide what to do with it.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah. The public also has a big role to play. And I think, you know, it's a big takeaway from your investigative journalism that you're empowering the public to potentially get involved. And we just have about a minute left. So, Katie, I'll get your take on this. And then, Casey, we'll pass it quickly to you. But just for listeners who want to stay updated, want to get involved in this issue, or just learn more, what do you recommend?
I would recommend filing a Public Records Act request to your local agency to request these types of agreements and keeping tabs on what your local city council is doing and what sort of agreements they're signing with members of their police department. I mean, that's one way that you could be really vigilant and watch what's happening, because a lot of these agreements were agreed to in the open, but the terms were secret because they included monetary provisions. And so I would say that, and then also, you know, continue watching our reporting. We're not stopping in requesting these agreements from every agency across the state. And so we'll continue to do that with the investigative reporting program and report that out through the San Francisco Chronicle.
And Casey, real quick, where can listeners find your work?
Katie continues to work at the investigative reporting program, which is kind of been the heart of where this work has come out of. Mm-hmm. And she's continuing to publish in the San Francisco Chronicle. She's following the legislation in the Capitol. And that would be and then, of course, also following your local news to keep tabs on what local folks are reporting about what's happening in law enforcement there, because that was also pretty paramount to some of our early investigatory work as well.
Well, we'll put some links on our website. I just want to thank you both so much for joining us. Katie Roush, award-winning reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley, and Casey Smith, senior State House reporter for the Indiana Capitol Chronicle. Thank you both so much for your work and for coming on State of the Bay to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up after this break, you're going to hear my interview with Matt Dooley, the director of a new documentary by and for diehard Oakland A's fans called The Last Game, about the team's final game in Oakland and its long history in that city. We'll be right back. On the next episode of Your Call's One Planet series, investigative journalist Antonia Juhas joins us to discuss her new piece on Trump's so-called minerals agreement with Ukraine. A significant portion of Ukraine's natural resources, including fossil fuels and minerals, is in territory controlled and occupied by Russia. And then we'll turn to the debate over affordable and multifamily housing in Pacific Palisades following the recent wildfire. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Ethan Elkind, and you.
And that will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that takes place after 7:05, after the BBC News Hour, or excuse me, the BBC Headlines here on 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. After 57 years, the Oakland A's have finally left Oakland and will be spending the next 3 years, at least, playing in a AAA stadium in West Sacramento, while owner John Fisher attempts to raise the $1.6 billion that he says is necessary for a new stadium in Las Vegas. It's been a painful loss for Oakland A's fans, and one covered quite poignantly in a new documentary called The Last Game, directed by our guest, Matt Dooley. Matt Dooley, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you, Ethan, for having me. Really glad to be here.
Well, we're very happy you can join telling the story that I think is very near and dear to a lot of Oakland A's fans in the East Bay. And in the film, you interview some of the A's most devoted fans, and the love that these fans have for this team really comes through, which, of course, makes their departure from Oakland all the more painful. What made you want to make this film?
You know, I grew up as a baseball fan. I grew up in Little League. And as a kid, I always wanted to have a jersey for my hometown team, the Oakland A's. I grew up in Castro Valley, just around the bend from Oakland. My parents were Oakland A's fans, and I grew up going to those games. So for me, this has been a team that I've followed since my childhood. A's fans will know the Moneyball days of the Oakland A's, or movie fans will know the movie with Brad Pitt. But this has been a team that's been part of my life for the better part of 20, 30 years. So a lot like other A's fans, when I heard the rumblings of the A's officially moving to Las Vegas, this was a momentous time in Oakland A's history that I wanted to document. So back in 2023, when those conversations started to get more serious, I put together a film crew of other passionate filmmakers here in the Bay Area, just trying to capture the voices of the A's fans. And by the time we finished filming just at the beginning of this year, it almost can become a tribute to the love that the fans have of this team, the Oakland A's.
Well, what's really apparent in watching this film and hearing the stories from these fans is that this is so much bigger than baseball. For these fans, being a part of the A's community meant having a connection to their family. And I'm wondering what stood out to you in doing these interviews with all these really heartbroken fans.
One message was repeated over and over again, that this is a generational shared experience, right? Families are raised on it. You raise your kids on it. Your grandparents went to these games. I mean, the point of our documentary was really interviewing people who had been there since the first game in the late 60s, and then all the way to the last game in 2024. So this is something that spreads six decades. And I think the really important part of it was that shared sense of community. What makes this team special is, in what other environment, we kept on hearing over and over, can you just approach random strangers in the parking lot and start talking about your day? You start talking about the A's. And so it's a place for not only just baseball and for, you know, a team to exist, but it's a place for a community to flourish. And when you won't see that A's logo around on hats, on people's heads everywhere, you'll lose a sense of something that brought us together in the East Bay.
One of the nice things I thought about the documentary is that a lot of documentaries about sports teams, franchises, they'll feature interviews with some of the high-rolling players and top-level executives. But this is really a love letter to the fans. And as with any good movie, there has to be a villain. And in this case, the villain is the A's principal owner, John Fisher, who inherited his wealth from his parents, who started the Gap clothing store. I know the family is a big Giants fan family. He bought the A's, has never spent much money on the players. And it really comes through the resentment that the fans have towards John Fisher, feeling like this really was a story of greed. And one individual in particular wanted to make more money on gambling revenue, essentially, in Las Vegas. Can you talk about the sentiment of the fans you talked to towards John Fisher?
Well, even when the A's were winning world championships, they've always had a rocky ownership history. You go back to Charles Finley, who cheated a lot of the A's players out of salary and broke up the powerhouse teams of the 70s. So it's something that has been just a part of Oakland's DNA for whatever reason. And I think a lot of the resentment and built up anger towards the ownership group has been because of the last 20 years, the lack of investments in players, the lack of investment in the stadium. So I think a lot of the frustration comes from the fact that if fans feel like if we just invested a little bit more, we could have gotten that championship. We could have gotten that new ballpark stadium.
And of course, back when they had an ownership that invested in the team, they drew almost 3 million fans in the early 90s. I want to ask you about the last home game. That was on September 26th of last year. And I'm going to play a clip from the film of one of the fans recounting their experience at that game.
The last game was really painful, really painful. I'm sorry. There were random fans that were in tears, and they made me cry because it was the same thing that I was experiencing. So, and I'd grab them. No, I didn't know them. Didn't know them from anybody, and grab them and hold them and say, it's gonna be okay. And it's gonna be okay. You know, it's a majority of my life was spent being an A's fan, 50 plus years. From my childhood as a little leaguer all the way up into my adult years now, 70 years old, this ball club has been the only team I've ever rooted for. That green and gold is what I bleed. But the fact that we won it and sent 40,000 people home with a win, and they played the celebration song, which is, we kind of got used to hearing, sent everybody home happy on one final sad day.
So what was it like covering that game for the film when you were there that day?
You know, it felt, at least to me personally, like a calm acceptance. There had been a lot of speculation as to how that last game in Oakland would go. There was some worry that people would storm the field and be angry. But I think at the end of the day, the fans showed their love for Oakland and their love for this team. It was a very highly emotional moment. But for those that were able to make it, I think it was something very peaceful, something very cathartic. So it's going to be hard to see what the next steps are. But for right now, I think this documentary reflects some of those next steps for a lot of those A's fans that were there at the last game.
Well, let me ask you about those next steps. This is a pretty tight community in a lot of ways, diehard A's fans. What do you think is going to happen? What will the future hold for that community?
There's a lot of exciting possibilities. Just in our community, the Oakland Roots, the soccer team, has moved into the Coliseum Stadium to try and draw fans. So we'll see how many true believers they can convert from baseball folks. You also have the Oakland Ballers, who are in the newly minted Raymondi Park in Oakland, that are drawing really good crowds. They have a lot of passionate local fans that are growing the community there. So I think the spirit of Oakland fans will continue to carry on, regardless of whatever the venue is. I think there is a wound that's left in the community from not only the A's leaving, but of course the Warriors and the Raiders. We talked to a couple fans who are of the opinion that Sacramento and Vegas may not be a sure thing. And until shovels are in the ground in the desert in Nevada, we'll see what the next step actually for the A's are. Because of right now, they're floating between a minor league park and a non-existent major league park. So there may come a time when the A's are back in Oakland at some point in the distant future, but we'll have to stick around and keep our hearts open.
And I know, Matt, that you have an upcoming screening of the last game in Castro Valley that's quickly sold out. Where else might our listeners be able to watch the film?
We'll have some potential theater opportunities in the East Bay. We have some social media Instagram page at the Last Game Doc, D-O-C, that's available. We'll post some more information about theater showings that we'll have for the public there.
Well, congratulations on the film. It's really a moving film, and I think is very cathartic for A's fans who are really hurting about this loss to the community, to the East Bay as a whole. And I just want to thank you, Matt Dooley, for joining us here on State of the Bay and sharing the story behind the last game. And I hope listeners get a chance to watch it.
Thank you, everyone. Hope you get a chance to watch it soon. And let's go A's.
Go A's. Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll unpack the realities of long COVID with expert insights. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Katie Colley and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Stay tuned for my hosting of Your Call. It's a rebroadcast coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.